Look around. What do you see? Cars. Lots of them. And guess what? They're probably on Auto Trader. Whether you're into timeless classics or the latest trends, did somebody say solar-powered, eco-friendly, vegan, leather-wrapped, aromatherapy-scented, disco ball-equipped, self-driving car? If you see it on the road, you can likely find it on Auto Trader. Big cars, small cars, blue cars, new cars, used cars, electric cars, and one day, maybe even flying cars. With millions of options to choose from, buying a car becomes a whole lot easier. See it, find it, Auto Trader.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
This delightful program is brought to you by Squarespace. Beautiful websites for beautiful bands like walkthemoonband.com. So the name of their tour is Talking is Hard. It's not that hard, guys. I'm doing it now. Most of the time I can't stop talking. I mean, you literally would have to cut me off. One time I told...
Yeah, Alec Baldwin, we get it. You are talking too much, but you like Squarespace and we like Squarespace, so we appreciate you getting on our podcast to help us plug one of our great sponsors.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant, and Jerry's here, and it's Stuff You Should Know from the future, but not really.
How you doing?
I'm fine.
Well, good.
That's good.
I enjoyed this topic. I thought it was kind of neat.
Yeah, it was funny. Like, when you're reading about futurology and futurologists, a.k.a. futurists, mm-hmm. you tend to want to make it, like, more than it actually is.
Yeah.
And when you look into the topic, it keeps having to be beaten down just because of the name alone.
Yeah, you sound like a little bit like a wackadoo.
A wackadoo.
You say you're a futurist.
A seer.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes they're thinking about, they're using these really neat techniques to predict the future. They're talking about some really mundane stuff.
Yeah.
Boring stuff. Economic forecasts. Things like that.
Ugh.
How much oil will be left in 30 years.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. But then, on the other hand, if you're a futurologist, you may also be tasked with figuring out what technology we're going to be using in 30 years.
Yeah.
Or, you know, what color the shiny jumpsuits we're all going to wear will
yeah.
be. That kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite things is to look at past future predictions.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, there's nothing that'll make someone look less knowledgeable than going back to what they thought the future would look like in the year 2000.
Right.
Like back in the 1930s or 40s. Or sometimes some of those things happen.
Yeah, and then it's amazing.
Yeah, then it's like, wow, you know.
Because
sometimes something to this.
These guys are like really, really dead on. And I was reading an article, I think it was in Harvard Business Review, and it was a post by Paul Sappho, who runs a venture capital firm, I believe, called Discern.
Yeah.
And Paul Sappho was saying, like, he was trying to get across that sci-fi authors and futurologists,
uh-huh.
their paths overlap quite a bit, but really there's pretty big distinctions. And even in this article, they got lumped in together.
Yeah.
Because sci-fi writers do definitely use futurology techniques, but Paul Sappho was saying, like, yeah, but a real futurologist, you have to use logic. Whereas
right.
if you're a sci-fi writer, you can just use your imagination. You don't have to back it up with anything.
Yeah, it's
you're
great.
A futurologist, you have to use logic that makes sense to the whoever's hearing your prediction.
Yeah, and I think that's one reason why some sci-fi writers have been right on the nose with some future predictions, because they're not hampered by logic, and they can just freeform, you know?
Yeah, but then it's just a lucky guess.
No, I don't think so. I think they're still applying a lot of the same rules of futurology.
Yeah.
But they're just not bound by, you know, the laws of, well, not the laws, but You know what I mean?
The laws of logic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I'm with you. But that's the best science fiction, though, I think, is something that logically makes sense.
Yeah.
But, because then it's just fantasy.
Yeah, that's true. So futurology is recognizing and assessing potential future events. I could have sworn Jonathan Strickland wrote this, by the way it read.
Yeah.
But it was not.
No.
It's very Strickland-esque.
Nicholas Gerbus.
Yeah. That's Strickland's alter ego.
I wonder if it is. I've never met this Nicholas Gerbus.
But the point Gerbus makes, which I think is good, is it's a product of our times in many cases. Like, depending on where we are as a society, and like, he makes a great point, during the Civil War, there probably weren't a lot of, like, rosy predictions for the future. American Civil War.
Sure.
But in the Gilded Age, people are a lot more optimistic, so they may have, you know, it's a whole different deal. Like, during the Cold War, for instance.
Right.
A lot of paranoia, a lot of cynicism.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not going to be a rosy outlook for the future.
Right.
Like during the Gilded Age.
When it was rosier.
Yeah, way more optimistic than the Cold War.
Which is kind of ironic because the Gilded Age didn't have anything to be optimistic about. They were just pretending, hence the name.
Yeah.
The thing is, what you've just said, though, is kind of an argument against futurology. Because one of the big critiques of it is that a futurologist, they're not doing anything. Even if you're commenting on the past or the future, you're still really commenting about your present, your contemporary time, because that's what you...
Or recent past.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's what you what you've lived through and experienced. That's all you can really reflect on is
yeah.
And futurology seeks to go beyond that.
Well, yeah, that makes sense, though. If you, like, look at this thing that is happening now,
mm-hmm.
or just happened,
yeah.
then what is going to be happening in that thing in 10 years?
Right.
And it's a lot of times based on how the direction it's currently going.
Yes. Okay. So Gerbus makes a pretty good, gives a good example that the cell phone grew out of the telegraph, which ultimately is related further back to the smoke signal.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
But if you were a futurologist hanging out around somebody who was sending smoke signals, would you be able to predict the cell phone?
Probably not.
Probably not.
Could you predict the impact of the automobile or the highway system?
Right.
Maybe. But would you predict that people would have sex in the back seat of a car? Because
maybe.
It provides a little... Well, I don't think they did. Or
urban
could you,
sprawl.
Yeah, could you predict exurbs?
Yeah.
And edge cities, just because the highways got built.
Yeah, and not a lot of people did, even though a lot of people said, there's going to be horseless carriages one day, and they're going to change things big time. People are going to be able to move around a lot more.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that everybody saw every result of the automobile. It was a game changer.
Yeah.
Is what you could call it.
Agreed.
So what we're saying here, and if it sounds a little weird that we're at once supporting and criticizing futurology, that's basically the fun thing to do when you talk about futurology is to criticize it and be awed by it, because a lot of times they really are super right.
That's right. Futurology has been around for a long time. I mean, since people were writing fiction, there were people predicting the future.
Right.
But as far as... things didn't really get going as far as it being meaningful until after World War II, when the U.S. started developing technological forecasting. Basically, mm-hmm. like, it was really important to try and see where things were going militarily.
Right.
Because it was super expensive to develop new technologies. It could take a long time. So they started thinking, hey, we need to get some people on board that can kind of hopefully predict where we're headed here so we can make the right decisions.
Yeah, because if it takes a really long time, like you said, to develop a weapon, by the time you have that weapon deployed in the field, you're going to need to know it's not already obsolete.
Right.
The only way to do that is to predict what kind of warfare you're going to be engaged in.
Yeah.
Because this is a time, like at the end of World War II, so many inventions came out of World War I and II, war machine inventions, that things were changing so quickly that there was actually, you can kind of put modern futurology into the lap of one guy, an Air Force general named Hap Arnold, who saw that things were changing so fast that his Air Force needed to basically predict the future and see what direction it needed to go.
Right.
So he looked around and he started tapping people to do that. One of the first people he tapped was a scientist, an aeronautical engineer named Theodore von Karman.
Yes, he was a super smart dude. Mm-hmm. And he led a team that did predict a lot of stuff, like drones. And as far as, you know, the military using drones, not your uncle who flies it around the neighborhood.
Right.
Just to film stuff.
He predicted the rise of Brookstone.
target-seeking missiles, supersonic aircraft, and even the atom bomb.
All of this was in one report.
Yeah.
To Hap Arnold. And this guy knocked it out of the park. But he and his group were very much limited to small academic and military circles. Like, the general public wasn't aware that this was going on. But his group, von Karman's group, so accurately foresaw the direction that that modern warfare was going.
Yeah.
That you can very easily make the case that, no, he basically created a roadmap to the future that the Air Force followed. So his prophecies were self-fulfilling.
Yeah.
Because he said, go this way, and the Air Force went that way.
Yeah.
And created all this stuff.
Yeah, and then the military and, the Rand Corporation specifically, it grew out of the U.S. Air Force and Douglas Aircraft in the mid-40s. They said, well, having one person to say these things is great, but what we need is a team and a consensus among this team. So they kind of, they very much patented a technique they called the Delphi technique,
mm-hmm.
D-E-L-P-H-I. And that is basically a technique where they're trying to get agreed on consensus from a number of people.
So there's this very famous story about how the Navy, I think, lost a submarine, a nuclear submarine, or the Russians had lost a submarine, something like that. There was a lost sub that they wanted to find, and they had no idea where it was. So the Navy polled all these different different experts in all these different fields that might have something to do with nuclear submarines, weather,
yeah.
Aeronautics, people from NOAA, all these people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And asked them, where do you think this sub is? And no one hit it on the nose. But when they basically used statistical distribution of these various opinions,
yeah.
guesses of professionals, it led them right to that sub. And that's what the Delphi technique does, too. It takes opinions of experts in various fields and says, what do you think of this? And everybody sends in a questionnaire anonymously, and there's no group meeting, so the
yeah.
group doesn't bow to pressure,
sure.
no leaders emerge. They're giving their unvarnished opinion, and then after those opinions come in, they take that information and send it out again. So it goes in rounds and rounds and rounds until they finally come to a group consensus that in the future, we're all going to be wearing metallic blue jumpsuits.
Yeah, and what they're doing is generating what's known as a scenario. And a guy named Herman Kahn, K-A-H-N, worked with Rand in the 1950s. And he's the one that kind of coined the term scenario as it applies to futurology.
Right.
A pretty good definition I found was scenario is a detailed portrait of a plausible future world, one sufficiently vivid that a planner can clearly see and comprehend the problems, challenges, and opportunities that such an environment would present. So it's you know, it's saying in the future we're going to have a scenario where there are going to be robots in every house.
Yeah.
Old.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest ways that they work on scenarios is with something called backcasting, which is starting at the end, which mm-hmm. is you got a robot mm-hmm. in every house.
Right.
And then go backwards.
To how you got there?
Yeah, to how you got there.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah. And scenarios, that's a pretty cool scenario. They can also be as mundane as running a fire drill where you're envisioning the fire broke out in the high school gym.
Right.
And so everybody needs to get out. That's a scenario. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
The weather forecasts or economic forecasts that are run through computer algorithms. The computer algorithms, the model, the process that it's going through is the scenario, and it spits out a possible prediction.
It's almost
same
like
thing.
Effect then cause.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Excellently put.
Thank you. So Herman Kahn worked with Rand and,
Did you look him up at all?
Oh yeah.
He's one of the inspirations for Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah.
He was described as a super genius.
Yeah, he was super smart, and he kind of was a bit of a celebrity at the time. He wrote a book in 1961 called On Thermonuclear War, and then went on to form left Rand to form the Hudson Institute, where he basically was like, "We're a group that is going to forecast the future."
So
and he became it was a like super popular book.
Yeah,
and it spawned a lot of other books. Similar books.
Well, we need to take a break, but we're getting we'll get right back to this in a second.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you. With professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes. That it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Chuck, you were just talking about Herman Kahn being the super genius who is something of a celebrity. I read that Timothy Leary intimated that he had taken acid with him.
I believe it.
He was a part of the inspiration for Dr. Strangelove. And this book that he wrote called The Year 2000, A Framework for Speculation on the Next 33 Years.
Yeah.
It basically established this outlook that that America and capitalism could do anything thanks to basically technological inventiveness.
Yeah, here's let's hear some of these. There was a list in that book, 100 technical innovations very likely in the last third of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
100. Some of the first 10, multiple applications of lasers, boom. High strength structural materials, nailed it, wouldn't you think?
Alloys.
New or improved materials for equipment and appliances. Now, that's easy.
Yeah.
Anyone can say that.
Sure.
There should be better material in the future.
I predict that now for 2050.
Longer range weather forecasting, more reliable weather forecasting.
No, I don't know about that one. I think that was a miss.
How about this? Here are a few of the other ones. New techniques for cheap and reliable birth control, for sure.
Yeah, the pill.
I don't know if the pill was around. We should do a whole thing.
It may
on
have
pill.
Been the same year because it came out in 67.
Was it?
Yeah. Well, this book came out in 67.
Right,
I mean.
Right. Widespread use of nuclear reactors for power.
Duh.
Improved capability to change sex of a children or adult.
Gender reassignment. We did a great episode on that.
Pervasive business use of computers.
Yeah, they're all over.
Personal pagers.
Yeah, they came and went.
And then one of the other ones was home computers to run households and communicate with the outside world.
Yeah, the Internet of Things.
Yeah.
They also predicted the rise of the credit economy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that we currently are in.
Interesting.
Yeah, so and that was just like a list, like a sidebar,
yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, in the book.
In this book. But the whole idea that America and capitalism in the West could invent its way out of any problem we possibly ran across in the future was the premise or the position of this book, and it caused an enormous furor.
Yeah.
In academic circles. And not just academic circles, because this book was one of the first to introduce to the public that there were such things as think tanks like RAND.
Yeah.
And
or
that
the Club of Rome.
Yeah, and that these people were sitting there thinking about the future and were writing books about it. And it kind of became a hip thing. But the Club of Rome was basically diametrically opposed to the outlook that Herman Kahn had. And the Club of Rome was a business consortium that conspiracy theorists say is basically the seat of the New World Order.
They're still around.
They are. And the Club of Rome basically said, no, we are establishing the gloom and doom camp that there is such thing as resource depletion, overpopulation, and we are basically doomed.
Yeah, I mean, we've covered this a lot on the show, different people that have made wild predictions about we're going to run out of this by this year.
Like Thomas Malthus.
Yeah, very Malthusian.
Mm-hmm.
One of the books that came out of the Club of Rome in 1972 was called Limits to Growth by Donella H. Meadows, Dennis Meadows, Jürgen Randers, and William Behrens at MIT. And they had a very dire, apocalyptic outlook of the future, as did a lot of other people at the time. And a lot of these were way off base, a lot of these dire predictions.
Right.
You know, it's happened over and over again.
Yeah, and so on the Club of Rome's website, they defend the limits to growth. Or no, not the limits to growth. The limits to growth book, basically saying that it's often miscited as predicting the collapse of civilization.
Yeah.
Due to renewable resource overuse.
Right.
And it doesn't do that. But they did use these same kind of techniques that Herman Kahn and some of his other colleagues were coming up with by taking population information, food production data,
sure,
industrial production, pollution, and non-renewable resource consumption, and then running scenarios through this model that they built using computers.
Right.
And coming up, the scenarios they came up with were kind of grim. The thing is even though they missed the mark, they still helped establish a very young idea that you can't just throw your McDonald's styrofoam on the ground.
Right.
You can't drive a car that gets 2 miles per gallon.
Right.
Like, we can't live like everything is just forever abundant, that there's no such thing as scarcity.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, though. Like, I totally agree. But then it also, when you're wrong about these things, it gives cynics something to point to say,
sure,
well, see, we didn't run out of oil in the early 1980s like you said we would.
And we
so why
didn't
do anything about it?
Yeah. I mean, man, that is a great point. It's a very great point. But at the same time, what you're seeing here between the limits to growth and the year 2000, we still see this today with,
sure,
climate change.
Oh, yeah.
You know? It's like, let's do something about climate change. The other people say, no, we can invent our way out of it. And besides, if we do something about climate change, it's going to mess with the economy.
Right.
And these people are saying, forget about the economy. We are all going to die.
Yeah, or not necessarily forget about the economy, but maybe you can do both.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, my whole deal with that has always been just like, why take that risk?
Well, we humans aren't very good at, like, preparing for future risk. Which is, I think, one of the reasons why futurologists are so revered and awed, but also mocked and scorned. Because they're doing something that's almost flies in the face of human nature.
Yeah, you're really putting yourself out there,
mm-hmm,
when you predict some of this stuff.
You are. That was one other episode that just reminded me of, the 10,000-year clock.
Oh, yeah.
That was a great one.
Yeah. So the military, the United States military, obviously has used it for years. Then beginning, when was this, in the 60s or 70s that business got into it?
So in 1972, I think, Royal Dutch Shell heard, somebody at the top heard that there wasn't going to be any oil by 1985, and they went, what?
Yeah, businesses basically said, wait a minute, there are people that can actually use models to determine what the future might look like.
Right.
How can we use that to make money?
Well, let's throw money at them and find out.
Exactly.
A couple of other places, too, that were nascent think tanks, like RAND, was the Stanford Research Institute Futures Group and the California Institute of Technology.
Yeah.
Early, like, kind of think tank breeding grounds. Just smart people walking around thinking about the future. But that wasn't enough. You can't just say, this is what I think it's going to be like. You have to back it up. And we'll talk about how they back it up right after this.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
How do they back it up?
Well, they use different techniques. If you're a futurist or a futurologist, you're going to be using techniques that are pretty recognizable, but the way you put them together and the things you sort out is what's going to make you successful or not successful, right? So you might brainstorm ideas.
Yeah, that's probably where you start.
Yeah.
It's just like blue sky territory, as they say.
Yeah, you imagine things using scenarios or games. Apparently game theory.
But we got to do that at some point.
Yeah, I've been avoiding it because it's so...
It's a mind bender.
We could mess it up really bad.
Yeah.
But we'll do it. That changed the futurism field tremendously when they came up with game theory, because it's a pretty good way of predicting how people will work. And that's one of the big confounding factors is you can predict something, follow every single one of these steps that we're talking about right now, and then people will just cut to the left all of a sudden. And your prediction just fell to the wayside because humanity went this way real quick.
Yeah, or somebody invented a game changer, a game-changing product or innovation that nobody saw coming.
Yeah, what's that called? Disruptive technology?
Is it?
Yeah.
That's a good... I like that. Not a bad band name.
Oh, I wonder if it's out there. If so, it's like Silicon Valley rich guys.
Yeah, this is like my side band.
Right. Do you want to gather professional opinions using, say, the Delphi technique?
Yeah.
You want to do historical analysis?
Sure.
Current trends are very huge and can help you as well. And then, like you were saying, I think you call it backmasking?
No. That's turn me on, dead man.
Right.
From the Beatles.
Yeah, that's what they do. They listen to the Beatles backwards. What was it? It's not backmasking, I know. But where you envision a future and then you work your way backward from it. When you do this, you do all this stuff together. And again,
backcasting. Yeah.
And when you're using this along with computer algorithms that can model like the economy or the weather or oil consumption or something like that, you can come up with something that you could rightly say is a prediction or a forecast for the future, where we're going to be.
That's right.
Again, though, just things happen. Like, for example, Herman Kahn did not predict the the oil crisis that came the year after he wrote another famous book.
Yeah.
In 1972. He wrote a response, I think, to Limits to Growth and just totally missed the oil crisis.
Yeah.
But how could he predict that? Because the oil crisis came out of the OPEC oil embargo that was punishment for the U.S.'s being involved in the Yom Kippur War.
So you couldn't see that coming.
No, and that's the big problem with futurology.
Yes, exactly. Our own U.S. government has been wrong. The U.S. Department of Interior announced twice in 1939 and then in 1951 that we only had 13 years of oil left.
Yeah.
It's so weird that both times it was 13 years.
They don't like to bother people, so they wait until there's 13 years left and they sound
like... Is that what it is? It's just such a specific number.
It is.
What else? Well, we've talked about Moore's Law before. That has aged a little better than some other futurology predictions because it has been revised over the years, which is sort of a cheat.
A little bit, but still.
What I really meant was
right.
This. It's,
I think it went from 18 months to 2 years or something like that. But what's funny is Gerbus stakes his position in this article. He's saying, like, the Limits to Growth and the other Club of Rome stuff, they missed the mark because they predicted catastrophe.
Yeah.
And Moore's Law predicts technological innovation, so it's successful. So
yeah.
Clearly, Gerbus agrees with the Herman Kahn group rather
right.
than the Club of Rome group. I don't think it's subtle. I think you can't just say like the gloom and doom camp has just been completely eradicated or proven wrong.
Agreed.
You know?
Yeah, Moore's Law, I don't even think we said specifically. It predicts the number of transistors on integrated circuits in computers doubles every 2 years.
Right.
And like we said, it's been updated and it's been pretty consistent.
And so with Herman Kahn's popularity and then the big high-profile book publishing argument that he got in with the Club of Rome, that led to like a spate of other futurology books that
were
kind of
popular. Yeah, I
remember
it being a big deal when I was a kid. I remember a lot of people talking about the near and far future.
The one that I ran across in this article that I had heard of but I didn't know anything about is Alvin Toffler's Future Shock.
I remember that, I think.
Did you read it?
No.
The cover, I guarantee, would just give you nostalgia, I'm sure.
Oh, really?
But it came out in 1970, and it predicts a future where too much rapid change, technological change and advancement, it happens too quickly, and people get all sorts of stressed and just worn out and basically have all manner of terrible reactions to it. And I'm like, well, that guy predicted 2015.
So, like, a person's emotions couldn't handle?
Yeah, we're just overwhelmed.
Okay.
Through too much rapid technological innovation. Happens too quick.
Do you think we're overwhelmed?
Like, I get stressed out by, like, say, social media or something like that. Yeah.
I wonder if it's people of a certain age.
Maybe. Yeah, I would guess if you're born into it, you're used to it. So it would probably more likely apply to a transition population like
right.
us.
The transitional generation, is that what we are?
Don't you get stressed by social media? Don't you get, like, just tense and...
Yeah, I mean, I kind of just hate it.
Or having, like, having information, all this information, and
yeah.
all of it's just so thin.
Yeah.
Content-wise or value-wise, but there's tons of it.
Yeah.
And it's always coming at you.
Yep, always.
That stuff wears me out.
It wears me out, too.
I got the future shock, Chuck.
Yeah, you got the Jimmy legs?
Yeah.
No, I totally agree. I'm like that. I just want to shut it all down.
Just shh, everybody. Not podcasts, though.
Right? That should live on. So we talked about science fiction writers and how they are easily off the hook because they're just writers, right? They're not supposed to predict the future. But they have been, you can't dismiss it because they've been on the money or close to it a lot over the years.
Yeah.
Because, like we said, they're not hampered by the rational laws of today. They can just say whatever they want. And if they're wrong, it's like, hey, dude, I'm just writing stuff.
Yes.
This is fiction.
Right.
But a few of the highlights, Jules Verne, mid-19th century, predicted going to the moon in a spacecraft.
Not only that, so he predicted it would be shot out of a cannon, basically.
Yeah, big gun.
But the thing that he really got, though, was that he placed the moon shot in Florida.
Yeah.
Like 137 miles from Cape Canaveral, where they do launch rockets to the moon.
Not bad.
No, and for the same reason, too, like that it's close to the equator.
Oh, is that why?
That's one of the reasons why. Plus, Cape Canaveral is largely protected by the Gulf Stream from hurricanes. Like, as a hurricane comes ashore, right before it starts to get to Canaveral, it goes out again and then hits North Carolina.
Interesting. That'd be an interesting conversation to have been in on.
Like, when they were picking places?
Yeah, like, where should we launch this? I mean, where should we put all of our money into?
Right.
H.G. Wells, he predicted tanks.
Yeah, he was good at it. Supposedly, he was the first guy to really think of himself as a futurist.
He predicted the atom bomb in 1908, aerial bombing in 1908. The name Robot was actually coined by a science fiction writer, a Czech writer named Karel Kapek. And in 1921, he named robots.
I think the all-time winner, though, is Hugo Gernsback. And Hugo Gernsback, if you're into science fiction, you recognize his first name because he's who the Hugo Award is named after. You may also recognize his last name, too, if you're a Hugo Gernsback fan. But back in, I think, the 1910s,
he was writing.
Yeah, he wrote a book called Ralph 124C41+. He predicted everything in this.
Yeah. You know what that means? It's actually a play on words. It means 1, 2, 4, C for one another. You get it?
Wow, yeah, that's great.
1, 2, 4, C for one, and then another is the plus sign.
Yeah, yeah.
That alone, I was sold.
Yeah.
I was like, I love this guy.
It's just like that Van Halen album, OU812.
Exactly. So what has he predicted? He predicted solar power, like the realistic use of solar power. He predicted plastics. Video phones, tape recorders, jukeboxes, loudspeakers.
Tinfoil, rust-proof steel, synthetic fabrics, all in one book. And he's famous, and the Hugo Award's named after him, because he wanted to make science fiction more science-based.
Yeah.
You know, using that same logic. So he would have been a very, almost a father of futurology.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know?
Here's a few other things that from that book. This one, to me, I'm surprised no one's done this yet. The appetizer, which is at a restaurant, in an scientifically advanced restaurant, it'll be a room that you wait in before you get your table that's flooded with gases that make you hungry.
Oh, yeah.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Just have a seat in the appetizer room. We'll be ready shortly.
There's bloody fingernails scratched into the walls as people are trying to get to the other room where the food is.
The telautograph, which is basically a fax machine.
Okay.
The telephot, which was a picture phone. It had a universal translator where they translate any language right there on in your hand.
Yeah.
Not bad. And then this one I love, the vacation city. Was a suspended city in a domed suspended city, 20,000 feet in the air, that used a device that nullified gravity. And in Vacation City, no mechanical devices are permitted because it was supposed to be a true escape.
That's awesome.
From the mechanized world.
Waiting for that one.
And this was in 1911.
Yeah.
He predicted just that there would be a need for that.
That's like that town in West Virginia. Green something West Virginia, where the people who have electromagnetic sensitivity go because you're not allowed to have any electromagnetic stuff.
Oh, really?
Because there's a radio telescope or there's something there
that could be Amish.
Could be interfered with.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could go be Amish.
Can you just be Amish?
No.
Like, hey, I want to be Amish.
If you're Harrison Ford, you could be.
Yeah, or Woody Harrelson.
Yeah.
Right? You got anything else? How about these predictions for the future?
There's a couple in here that are kind of funny.
10 predictions that missed the mark. And these are real predictions. In 1967, U.S. News and World Report said that by the end of the century, we will launch our freight across the continent with missiles. You order something from Amazon in New York, instead of having a fulfillment center nearby, they just put it in a missile and shoot it to you.
Yeah.
Didn't happen.
No, but drones are coming.
Are they really? Are they still on that?
Probably.
Okay.
In 1955, a guy named Alex Lewitt predicted nuclear power vacuum cleaners.
This one, I think, would be pretty great. Dissolving dishes.
Yeah.
And asked what it would be like in the year 2000, a science writer named Waldemar Kampfert. There's a lot of... Man, one, two, three, four, five.
He's the fabulous science writer with the funny name.
Consonants in a row. He said you would basically put your plate in 250-degree water at the end, and it would just dissolve it. No more dishwashing.
Bucky Fuller predicted that Canada would be a subtropical climate because we would build a dome over it. And that didn't happen.
No, it didn't.
Which is strange because Bucky Fuller was a pretty sharp dude.
Here's another one. Was he really?
Yeah, Buckminster Fuller.
Oh, I didn't pick up on that.
He's who Bucky Balls are named after.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I don't know. He may have invented them. I'm not sure.
Huh. What's Bucky Ball?
It's those little balls that are magnetic spheres that like you can shape into
awesome.
Bucky Balls.
Yeah, yeah. Here's one. A Scottish geneticist that... said in the 1920s that in the future, one-third of the babies would not be born. Oh, only one-third would be born as a result of pregnancy. And the other babies would be born in a lab. Would they be grown, basically?
Exogenesis.
Yeah.
Here's the last one, Chuck. You ready? 1975, ready. The Research Institute of America, which sounds pretty smart, said that by 1975, I'm sorry, this is several years before that, we would all be driving personal helicopters.
Yeah.
Did not pan out. Probably never will. I don't know if I'd want a personal helicopter.
You know, I was, for Emily's birthday, I rented a cabin in the North Georgia Mountains.
Mm-hmm. Did you take
friends.
A personal helicopter there?
No, but I was sitting on the deck, we all were, and way across the valley on the side of a mountain was this huge, huge house. And I heard a sound of a helicopter, and I was like, and I saw a blinking light. I got out the binoculars, and this dude had a helicopter.
Wow.
And he took it, and he flew it down about 2 miles to the lake at the bottom of the valley.
Uh-huh.
And I guess he has a lake house and a mountain house, and the easiest way to get there is to make the 4-minute helicopter flight.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
It was
pretty amazing.
Wow.
I want to know who that guy is. Not guy. Could be a lady.
Yeah, it could be.
What am I saying?
Could be Carly Fiorina.
Yeah. Who's that?
She's the woman who's running for GOP president candidate.
Oh, right.
Fiorina. That's right.
Gotcha.
Go ahead.
I'm done.
Oh, sorry. Let's see. Well, if you want to know more about futurology, you can type that word into the search bar at howstuffworks.com. And since Chuck had an anecdote about helicopters, it's time for listener mail.
It sort of looked like one of those Magnum PI ones, too.
Well, if I did have a personal helicopter, it would look an awful lot like that.
I'm sure it would. Hey, guys, my name is Shelby. I'm honored for you to be reading this. My husband and I love your show, and you've solved our dilemma as to what to listen to in our car together. I want to let you know you did a great job on the HIV/AIDS podcast. However, I think you missed telling a really important story about the AIDS crisis. Just before the AIDS crisis broke, a method for treating hemophilia called clotting factor concentrate was developed. Finally let those suffering from the disease live into adulthood and completely change the landscape of the disorder. By the time HIV was discovered to be a blood-borne virus, many of those suffering from hemophilia already had it, not to mention that many also contracted hepatitis. However, the pharmaceutical companies did not begin to pasteurize the drug in spite of their knowledge that it was spreading HIV until a strong public outcry prompted a government intervention. I think the story is not told often enough, and the injustice that these individuals suffered at the hands of Big Pharma is undoubtedly one of the greatest our country has seen.
Man.
There's an extremely informative and sad documentary on the topic called Bad Blood, a cautionary tale. Anyway, that's about it. And I'm sorry if I bummed everyone out.
That
Who
is that?
From Shelby.
Shelby, thank you for not only that illuminating email, but also the documentary recommendation. We're always looking for those.
Absolutely.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can tweet to us at SYSK Podcast. You can join us on Facebook.com/StuffYouShouldKnow. You can send us an email to StuffPodcast@HowStuffWorks.com. And as always, join us at our home on the web, StuffYouShouldKnow.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.